Hello and welcome to McLean's on the Hill. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio. Last weekend, 10 young people were arrested at a Montreal airport on suspicion they would be traveling to join a terrorist organization. The government is promising action, and Public Safety Minister Stephen Blaney is here to discuss the ongoing threat of terrorism. A new internal report from the Ottawa Police finds the sheer number of officers responding to the October 22nd terror attack led to confusion and incorrect reports of multiple shooters on that chaotic day. We speak with Inspector Mark Ford about the report and the lessons learned. The federal government has lost its bid to thwart a court challenge aimed at forcing the Prime Minister to fill Senate vacancies. Vancouver lawyer Aniz Alani, who launched the case, is here to explain why he thinks the unfilled seats are unconstitutional. And finally, the McLean's panel weighs in on the police investigation into RCMP destruction of data from the Long Gun Registry and why the NDP is improving in the polls. For your politics, for your power, welcome to The Hill. Last weekend, the RCMP arrested 10 young people at Montreal's International Airport and accused them of planning to travel abroad to join a terrorist group. Charges have not yet been laid in this case, and the youths have been released on bail as the RCMP continues its investigation. Now, a day after that news broke, Prime Minister Stephen Harper went to Montreal, and surrounded by police officers, he announced more funding for the RCMP and the Canada Border Services Agency to battle terrorism. The Mounties alone will get a boost of $150 million over 5 years, and Harper says it will go a long way to help with their investigative powers.
The RCMP has already put the integrated national security enforcement teams in place in our country's biggest cities. Some actions undertaken by the team here in Montreal have recently been in the news. We will be expanding the investigative capacities of these teams.
The CBSA, meanwhile, will be getting $5 million over that same period. But that's not all the government is doing in the wake of these terror arrests. To speak more about this incident and the government's actions, I'm joined on the phone by Public Safety Minister Stephen Blaney. Minister Blaney, first off, what was your reaction when you heard about 10 youths being detained and having their passports revoked for allegedly planning to head abroad to join a jihadi group?
Well, this is a large number that is a strong reminder of how serious the threat is and how it is important to make sure that we are providing the tool and the resources to those who are there to protect us, to keep us safe.
Are the youths being monitored since they've been released?
Absolutely. There are operational plans, and this is certainly one of my there is an operational little plan. We are working in close conjunction with the local police, with the Sûreté du Québec, and as you know, the RCMP, the INSET team, the Integrated National Security team. So those individuals are being part of an operational plan so that they don't represent a threat while here. And in the meantime, I also certainly want to congratulate the RCMP for this work and also the family. And this is quite encouraging to see that the family are being are getting actively involved in preventing these young potential young terrorists from traveling, and also getting involved in making our community safer by preventing terrorists to travel.
This was a large group of young people, and I mean, are you worried to see such a large group of young people trying to leave at the same time?
This is a strong reminder that in the current bill that is in front of the House, there is a provision for the promotion of terrorism. So we have to attack the problem at the source of the radicalizers, those who are preying on young individuals and luring them into radicalization. That's why we will be able to criminalize and lay charges against those who are radicalizing individual, as well as individual if they were to commit terrorist attack. What is important now, Cormac, is that we make sure that we have the resources and the tool. And what I feel is that there certainly has been an influence I fully have confidence in our police officer to get at the source of those who have radicalized those individuals.
You talk about resources and tools. Don't arrests and detentions like this prove that police do already, under the current system, have the resources available to prevent people from leaving and to head abroad to take part in terrorist activities?
Well, yes, thanks to the Combating Terrorism Act legislation we adopted in 2013 against the will of the NDP. Was it of the opposition where the Liberals are only providing lip service and the NDP were consistently opposing our anti-terrorism measure, our police officer would be armless. They would not be able to have responded in the way they did. So, yes, there are provision in place, but we need to go at the source. In our Bill C-51, there are additional measures that will make us even more efficient and intervene earlier. What we need to do is intervene in the pre-criminalization sphere, and that's how we will enable our intelligence officer to disrupt the threat by, for example, talking to the parents to tell them, your kid has a problem, you should take action before he gets a criminal record.
So let's talk about that outreach then. Wasn't the RCMP supposed to be renewing its radicalization outreach program at some point this year? What's the status with that? Where is that right now?
The status is when we've introduced our anti-terrorism, counter-terrorism strategy a couple of years ago. The first pillar of it is the prevention. The first pillar of our strategy is prevention. And the RCMP has reached out to community. As you know, we have a cross-cultural roundtable. We've been out there. We've been working with communities. But also, I will call a ministerial conference at the beginning of summer on anti-terrorism and radicalization, because we need to work together as a society, the government, the law enforcement, communities, and families to derail this phenomenon of foreign fighters that we are experiencing.
So who's going to be invited to that? Is it just going to be public safety ministers from around the country and yourself? Is it just going to be your counterparts? Are you going to be calling in experts? And what exactly will you be discussing at this meeting?
Yeah, we will have the ministerial and some guests as expert and specialist in the field. And we are moving forward as an overall. What we need to do is to have an overall strategy to prevent radicalization, and that's part of our prevention. We need to work even further to prevent things from what we've experienced in Montreal from happening. We are going to intervene at an earlier stage by moving forward into preventing radicalization.
In that prevention, are you going to start targeting? I don't want to say problem, but areas, regions where you see trends, because right now we're seeing a trend in Montreal, in the Quebec area, where we've had this year, we've had, I know it's a cross-country issue, but in Quebec, we've had those earlier, we had those six individuals who were able to travel abroad, two more were arrested, now we have 10. Will there be efforts to shift it to regions where you see trends, troubling trends like this?
Well, I was asked today if it was more especially a Montreal issue. I say no. We've seen a spike here and there. You may remember last week how strong we were. Some Western cities were tackling with the individual willing to travel to commit terrorist attack. Not so long ago, we've seen arrests in Ottawa. So this is an issue that we are facing countrywide. And of course, when there is a specific concern in a given region, well, we are working with local authorities to deal with this issue. But at this point in time, we certainly have to deal with those radicalizers. And frankly, this is, we need a national approach and target the areas where there is a more, I would say, where the need or where there is more individual who could be radicalized. But this is an operational matter at this point in time, and I fully have confidence in the RCMP working with the provincial authority and the local police to intervene.
I just have a couple of other questions just on a little bit of a different topic. Is the government still planning to use the budget bill to make changes to the law about RCMP destruction of the long gun registry data now that the OPP is investigating potential illegal actions?
Well, these are two different issues. From where I stand, as you know, I have full confidence that the RCMP not only has fully complied with the law, but also with the will of the Parliament. And I would tell you that I won't apologize for having indeed a long and wasteful long gun registry that has proven inefficient. We certainly are in favor of sound measures. Regarding it's now up for a decision. I fully have trust and the confidence and that the RCMP has fully complied with all the Canadian laws.
I mean, on many other issues, the government says, I'm sorry, there's an investigation underway by police or the matter's before the courts. Would it not be prudent and proper to wait for the investigation to see the results before you change the law?
This is a rather complicated issue, but at the end of the day, the result is fairly simple. The RCMP has complied with the law, and it is my belief. And in the other case, we are just ensuring that the will of Parliament is applied, and that's why we are moving forward with the BIA. So we intend to stay the course, as we are willing to make sure that all agencies are complying not only with the law, but also with the will of Parliament. And that's exactly what the BIA is accomplishing related to the justice issue. I'll leave it to, as you've just said, to the OPP to take whatever course of action it shall decide. But I'm confident that they will find out that the RCMP has fully complied with the law.
But how can you prejudge that when there is an investigation underway by the OPP? Would it not be proper to wait
for
the OPP?
At this point in time, the OPP is contemplating whether they will move forward or not with the case.
But they are investigating. They haven't laid charges. I'm not saying that, but I'm saying, you know, they are looking into the matter. They have confirmed that.
Yeah, but so as I just tell you, I have I'm confident in the RCMP, and it's up. It's a separate process actually.
Okay. Thank you very much, Public Safety Minister Stephen Blaney. I do appreciate it.
Thank you, Cormac.
That was Public Safety Minister Stephen Blaney discussing the latest terror arrests. The terror attack on October 22nd led to a day of chaos and confusion. When Corporal Nathan Cirillo was shot in cold blood at the National War Memorial, it started a flood of calls from terrified citizens. As the city was put on lockdown, confusion reigned. Witnesses claimed there were more shooters, and police had to try to determine if that was true. Well, that confusion lasted 8 hours, and it was only at that point that police were confident there was only one gunman. But a new internal report from the Ottawa Police Service finds that some of the incorrect reports were made because witnesses had confused responding officers with possible suspects. To talk more about the internal report from the Ottawa Police, I was able to speak with Inspector Mark Ford.
So first off, I understand that your internal report has found that officers may have played a role in the fact of confusion around whether there was one shooter or multiple shooters. What can you tell me that you found through this report?
Yeah, so that has come out. However, I want to sort of maybe correct that. The greatest part of the confusion that happened on October 22nd that presented itself to us was actually conflicting eyewitness accounts. There was a number of eyewitnesses that you know, that usually takes place during an incident like this, that saw maybe more than one suspect or conflicting descriptions, which led us to believe that there were more than one suspect. So that was a big challenge for us, and that's why it took so long before we were able to release the scene and advise the public that it was safe to go about their business. The issue did arise is that officers are trained to respond to a crisis such as this, as an active shooter. So officers did the right thing. They responded from all points on the compass. And the majority of those responding were frontline officers that are uniform. But we also had members that were detectives or plainclothes or undercover that had various markers or identifiers. And to the public, sometimes that can be confusing. That it could be construed as something not friendly. So it did contribute, but a small part.
What about those wearing balaclavas as well? Was that just to protect their identities? Because it can be confusing understanding that an attack's underway and seeing someone with a gun and a balaclava over their head, how that could be construed as possibly another suspect.
Yeah, that's understandable. A number of these officers that were engaged in a response that were in plain clothes did wear balaclavas. That is to protect their identification because they could be or were involved in sensitive investigations where we don't want their identity getting out to the public. And that is a standard procedure. But it is something that, as part of a review, we're looking to revisit and see if there's anything that we can do differently going into the future.
What about the issue of communications with superior officers, things like that? Was there an issue there where some people responded and you weren't aware of where they were at a time?
So an issue like this, you know, there was an excess of 300 police officers that were involved in a response. Some of them self-engaged, and it is a challenge in any incident that is of this scale, the tracking and the accountability for people that arrive on scene. So that is one of the things that we learned from this event, that there were some officers that self-engaged. The majority we knew exactly where they were, but there were some that we weren't aware where they were engaged and what they were doing, etc. And so that's something that we have to look at. And that's not unique to the city of Ottawa. That's an issue that other police services across North America have encountered on incidents that are of this scale.
So how does that pose a logistical issue for the police when you have an emergency situation like the one we had on October 22nd?
It's a couple things. Number one is that, you know, we want to make sure that we're effective and efficient in our response, that we aren't duplicating efforts because other officers that a commander may not be aware doing the same work as another group may be doing. Secondly, I think most importantly is we want to be able to account for and track all our officers from an officer safety standpoint, just in case something happen. We want to know where our officers are and if they need help, where we can go to assist them.
So with this, what changes will you be making? You said that there have been lessons learned. So how are you going to fix some of the issues that popped up moving forward in case, you know, knock on wood, anything like this should happen again?
Yeah, absolutely. This is something that's not unique to October 22nd. Anytime we have an incident, we debrief it. We look to what can we learn from what didn't go so well. But a lot of times, and this was a case in October 22nd, the officers responded remarkably well. They responded as they were trained for, and they were very professional and strong in their response. But having said that, we will look at what can we learn from this. There will be issues maybe around training. There may be issues around policy that we need to adjust. And there may be some technological solutions that we may need to inquire about.
And what about the issue of uniforms and plain clothes? I mean, since that did cause confusion and send the police in other directions that may not have been correct for the time, is there any talk about possibly changing policies about uniforms in situations like that?
Yeah, that is something that we'll look at and we'll review. But I do want to remind that the vast majority of the police officers that did respond were either uniformed or those that were in plain clothes had markers on them that indicated they were police. But there were some situations where maybe the markings weren't visible or weren't easy to see. So we need to, you know, review that and see if there's something that we can do better. And if we do, that will be addressed through policy and training.
I know I strayed a little bit from this, but when it comes to the response and trying to sort all of that out, I mean, you had a lot of witness accounts to sift through. You had some that were conflicting about the amount of shooters involved in this. Why did it take 8 hours to figure it all out?
It's just the nature of the way things unfolded. I think in a perfect world, we would have liked to have seen that streamlined. But the reality is that when an incident occurs in a downtown with multiple eyewitnesses, some coming in and reporting later on, that's what we're faced to deal with. And we're trying to deal with it as efficiently as possible so that we can eliminate the possibility that there was more than one suspect. But unfortunately, given what happened, it did take that amount of time. I think the review will speak to the fact that there really wasn't much more that we could have done differently in that regard. It was just the way it played out that day.
Will this report ever see the light of day publicly?
I think what you're hearing me talk about is there will be certain themes that we will be in a position to share with the public, either through the media or there will be a police services board report. But there are a lot of issues that are operationally sensitive and they're around tactics, and we don't share those with the public.
That was Inspector Mark Ford with the Ottawa Police Service discussing an internal report from Ottawa Police on the terror attack of October 22nd. Now, this report is separate from the one prepared by the Ontario Provincial Police that investigated the shooting inside Centre Block, which of course ended with Michael Zahaf-Babo's death after he had stormed Parliament Hill. We're still waiting for the public release of that report. Still to come on the show, we speak with a lawyer who has taken the federal government to court because the Prime Minister has not been filling Senate vacancies. And the Maclean's panel is here to talk about the controversy over the long gun registry data and a boost in the polls for the NDP. Welcome back to Maclean's on the Hill. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio. Coming up on the show, the Maclean's panel is here to discuss a polling boost for the NDP and that police investigation into the destruction of data related to the long gun registry. But first, the federal government has lost its bid to dismiss a court challenge, which is aimed at forcing Prime Minister Stephen Harper to fill the 20 vacancies in the Senate. Vancouver lawyer Aniz Alani believes that it's unconstitutional for the Prime Minister to allow these vacancies to build up. He says it leaves provinces underrepresented and hurts the Senate's ability to carry out its constitutional role in Parliament. Well, he wants the court to declare that the vacancies need to be filled in a reasonable time. Maclean's associate editor Aaron Wherry spoke with Aniz Alani by phone.
So Aniz, if you could just sort of walk us through what exactly you're trying to do, what exactly your challenge entails.
Well, the case is an application for judicial review to the federal court, and it's asking the court to issue a declaration based on the provisions of the Constitution Act, 1867, which say when a vacancy happens in the Senate by resignation, death, or otherwise, the Governor General shall, by summons to a fit and qualified person, fill the vacancy. It's asking for a declaration that the Prime Minister is required to advise the Governor General to fill those vacancies in the Senate within a reasonable time after the vacancy happens. And the reason I'm doing that is it became apparent in December of last year when the Prime Minister made some comments that he was not intending to fill the Senate vacancies that existed, that he was obviously under the impression that there was no constitutional requirement that he do so. When I heard about the comments, I pulled up a copy of the Constitution Act 1867 because it seemed iffy to me, and I looked at the provisions, and I just thought, I think you may be playing a little fast and loose with the language of the Constitution here. I grant you that it's not the most popular institution at all times, and there's certainly a lot of controversy surrounding it at the moment, but I don't think that changes the requirement that the Senate vacancies be filled. And as I did more reading into it, I saw, this was something that apparently happened before on a few occasions. It's something that the government's position seemed to be that there was no requirement. I believe the opposition leader said if he's prime minister, he would never fill vacancies. Then I, read some other commentators on the subject, and I just thought, there's obviously disagreement about what the Constitution means, and I didn't see any obvious way of resolving that disagreement other than going to the court and asking the judiciary to do as they always do and interpret the laws for us.
So the judge has now ruled that your case can go ahead, at least it won't, denying sort of the government's attempt to have the case tossed out. Are you, you know, beyond the mere fact that the case is going ahead, do you take much else from the judge's ruling as sort of heartening for your cause?
Well, Justice Harrington, you know, made some interesting comments and observations in his ruling, and he certainly asked a lot of thoughtful and I thought helpful questions at the hearing itself. But at the end of the day, the test that he was charged with applying is whether it was plain and obvious, as the government suggested, that I had no case at all, and so he was really only looking at it from the lens of, does this have any chance of succeeding? And if so, it should be allowed to continue. Obviously, I'm pleased with the ruling. I'm heartened that he concluded that it wasn't obviously bereft of any chance of success, as the government argued. But at the end of the day, it's going to come down to whatever the federal court judge hearing the application on the merits has to say.
How, you know, this, let's say this plays out and you win a ruling in your favor ultimately, like how, what would happen then, or what do you see happening then? Like could a court ever force the Prime Minister or the Governor General, I guess, to a certain extent, to appoint senators to the chamber?
Well, I mean, that's a good question, and there was certainly a lot of what the government argued would be problematic with the case when we were arguing the motion to strike. But at the end of the day, I don't think it'll come to that. I think right now, as I mentioned, there's obviously disagreement about whether there's any requirement that the vacancies be filled. And my hope is that if the court agrees that the requirement exists and is willing to issue a declaration, which is basically a ruling saying, here's what the law says and means, then that uncertainty will disappear. And to the extent that the Prime Minister or anyone else is relying on the argument that the Constitution doesn't say exactly when these need to be appointed, so it's not something that's reviewable, that argument disappears, and I would hope that the vacancies would be filled in due course without the need for any further litigation.
There is this idea that you know, people have floated the idea that, well, you know, you could just not appoint senators, and you could essentially, you know, abolish the chamber by stealth or neglect. I believe that argument has been shot down by the Supreme Court in its Senate reference. Does that sort of bolster your case that eventually senators have to be appointed?
I think so. I mean, the Supreme Court of Canada was very clear that when you look at the amending formula for the Senate, it does not contemplate any sort of indirect abolition by, you know, reducing the number of active senators. So given that we know that you can't do that indirectly, I think that certainly does speak to the argument that there must be an obligation to fill the vacancies. It also, you know, there's been a lot of discussion about, well, the quorum for the Senate is 15, so we're not there yet. It's not a problem. But that really overlooks the fact that, you know, each province and territory is guaranteed in the Constitution a specific number of senators. And so it doesn't do much to say for the folks of Manitoba, who only have three of their six senators, well, we're not at 15 yet, so don't worry about it.
How, you know, beyond the law, the and I think you've sort of acknowledged this, is there's, you know, going to be an argument that, you know, why do we even care about appointing senators? You know, why don't we sort of just let this go? You know, do you have a response to that? Do you see this as a, you know, a fundamental sort of philosophical idea that, you know, we should be appointing senators?
I think it comes down to we're a constitutional democracy, and that means that the Supreme Court of Canada talked about this in the Quebec Secession reference. They really looked at the organizing principles of our country and our constitution, and one of those is we believe in constitutionalism and the rule of law. Part of constitutionalism is the idea that we put certain things in the Constitution because we want to sort of protect against the chance that what we put in there might not be unpopular or might not be popular on any given day. So we've entrenched legal rights, we've entrenched democratic rights, the right not to be tortured, that sort of thing. We put it in the Constitution because we know that on any given day, the popular thing to do might be to do something else. So if we truly are a constitutional democracy, it's vitally important that we have respect for what our Constitution asks of us and directs us to do. And if we don't like what the Constitution says, we really have to take steps to amend the Constitution.
So what's the next steps? How does this proceed now? I mean, obviously the case went forward, but do you have dates and anything?
We don't have dates. I had, before the Justice Department had filed their motion to strike on January 15th, I actually just sent them a letter proposing a timeline for the whole case, which would have, just following the regular court rules, would have had us ready for a hearing sometime after late April of 2015. Of course, all of that timeline got suspended with their motion to strike because mm-hmm. we had to wait for a ruling before we could continue. So what we're going to do now is we'll have to put together a timetable for the remaining steps. My hope is, and I don't think it's out of the realm of possibilities, that we get our arguments filed in the coming weeks and months, and then hopefully have a hearing in the late summer or fall.
That was McLean's associate editor Aaron Wary speaking with Vancouver lawyer Aniz Alani about his court challenge to force the Prime Minister to fill vacant seats in the Senate. Still to come, the McLean's panel discusses the controversy over the long gun registry data, an NDP boost in the polls, and those vacancies in the Senate. Welcome back to McLean's on the Hill. It's now time for the McLean's panel. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio, and I'm joined by McLean's political editor Paul Wells and McLean's Ottawa Bureau Chief John Geddes. Thanks very much for being here, guys. All right, so we're going to start off with the MPs coming back to Parliament Hill next week. They're back on the job, and one of the big things they'll be discussing is the budget bill. And specifically out of that, we had the sort of rewriting of the law in that budget bill in regards to the long gun registry data. And we've learned as well that the OPP is now looking into and investigating the possibility that the RCMP may have broken the law by destroying some of the long gun registry data. We had the public safety minister on earlier in the show talking about it, and he basically defended the RCMP, said, "I'm confident that they followed the law, and there was no impression that I got that they're willing to back down on us, even though there's an investigation underway by a police force." So do you see the Conservatives eventually caving and holding off on this and taking it out of the budget bill, or are they just going to stand their ground on this?
I think they'll stand their ground. Caving is not really in the DNA of the government. I mean, very, very rarely do we see them cave. But it does two things, right? There's the specific issue of this measure they're doing to try to weirdly, go back in time and change the way the Information Act would have applied in a prior period. It's complicated and weird. But there's also a broader point, which is we've kind of gotten used to these bloated omnibus budget bills, the idea that all kinds of measures were pushed through kind of under the umbrella of the budget. And although it's been criticized and talked about, I think it had faded as a live issue. This will reignite that a little bit, right? And people will be reminded, and we'll see how clever the opposition parties are about hitting this. But one of the elements here is just the kind of sense that there's something sneaky, there's something underhanded about tucking this in at the back of a budget bill. Smacks of the kind of stuff that goes on in the U.S. Congress a lot of the time, where people try to, smuggle measures that aren't related to one law into another law. I'll be interested to see whether there's a kind of a way for the opposition parties just to frame that fact and make that an uncomfortable thing for the government.
Paul, I think a lot of Canadians are probably scratching their heads saying, how can the government retroactively change the law to prevent police from investigating a possible breaking of that law? Can the government do this?
Well, Cormac, it's pretty simple. the RCMP are fine because what they were doing was about to become legal. But because it isn't yet legal, the OPP has to investigate them because for the moment it still was illegal.
But that clarifies it for me. I know I see.
It was still was illegal.
It still was illegal. But soon it will have been was legal. And then the OPP will have been inappropriately investigating a thing that would have been legal.
Well, that clarifies everything.
But Paul, joking, it's interesting. The way you joke with this actually is illustrative, right? Because now, does that help the government, the fact that no one will be able to actually parse and understand this? Or does it hurt them? Because people will look and go, this just sounds dodgy, you know? There's two ways the public could respond to the news. They could go, what? I don't understand this. Or they could go, that sounds like a Weasley way to go about business on Parliament Hill.
The only guy who can really straighten this out is Bruce Willis in that movie Looper, who can go back in time and figure out what was wrong. Unfortunately, he'll meet his younger self. There's that. There's the extraordinary, apparently not unconstitutional, and maybe legally passable, according to some experts that colleagues have been asking this week. The government may yet get away with this, may yet have gotten away with it. But then there's the second issue that of these crackerjack budget implementation acts with a surprise every time. And, you know, so there was the one that changed the Navigable Waters Protection Act so that it no longer protected the waters and now protected the navigation. And now we've got this thing where this Russian doll legal scheme through time, which is fascinating.
Okay, I'm going to move along here off this time travel discussion that we're having here.
We've been sucking that long.
And we'll look to the future and some polling showing some positive signs for the NDP moving forward. They're getting some bumps in the polls. It's not just one national poll, but we're starting to see more regional polls, a boost in Quebec, a boost in BC as well. John, what's behind this boost for the NDP? Because some people look at it and say, it's the Alberta election, Rachel Notley. That's where you're getting this boost. But is there more to that?
You know, there's probably several things happening. I think for sure the Alberta election, I think I said on our panel a couple of weeks ago, I think one of the advantages there is it's not a very precise one, right? It's not that someone somehow takes the Alberta results and goes, oh, yes, let's project that onto the federal scene. It's that they're reminded that people elect NDP governments. It's not a crazy thing in Canada. It's gone to the provincial level forever, and it cast help the NDP when people are reminded that that can just happen, and nothing falls into the ocean as a result. But there's that. But there's also a couple longer term factors. One, Justin Trudeau's numbers and personal popularity has been softening since last September, I guess. Hey, Paul, would that be your understanding too?
Since a weird peak last September.
There's been a gradual falling off here. And at some point, you have to think if there are two parties on the center left, and one of them's leader is having trouble maintaining traction, well, the other is going to at some point look like it's getting a bounce, and maybe we're seeing that. And the other thing there is that we've had trouble in Ottawa figuring out what Tom Mulcair's, by consensus, strong performance in the House and on the Hill, how that translates to the broader population. Does it translate to the broader population? I think you have to assume right now that it's kind of translating, right? It, at least for left-of-center voters who would like to see Stephen Harper lose, hearing week after week that, well, Tom Mulcair does a good job holding the Prime Minister to account and sometimes even embarrassing the Prime Minister in the House of Commons, that has to, if you think about that set of swing voters between the Liberals and the NDP, that fact at some point has to resonate with them. It's always something to remember when we're thinking about polling, is that no factor has to resonate with all voters or even a majority of voters. Is something resonating with those voters who might be in flux? And maybe it is.
And Mulcair is going to try and resonate with voters more with his memoirs coming out shortly before the next election. But with the polling mainly, and maybe even the memoirs, Paul, how does this change the dynamic moving towards the fall election?
Well, it's striking. The group around Jack Layton, who delivered increased popular vote and seat counts in each of three consecutive elections, was essentially Brad Levine, Anne McGrath, and Brian Topp. Tom Mulcair became NDP leader and set them all packing. He has asked two of them to unpack. Ann McGrath is running his campaign. Brad Levine is a senior advisor. And it's Brian Topp who helped Rachel Notley win that Alberta election. The old gang is back together again. It's like Avengers Age of Ultron. And that's part of the secret of the excellent year that Tom Mulcair is having so far.
Okay, I love all the movie references we've been having
it's
so
a
far.
Culture panel. It's
Let's see if you can make it three for three on these topics. Okay. But we'll talk about Senate vacancies here as well. As we heard earlier in the show, there is a Vancouver lawyer who's trying to take the government to court because they haven't been filling vacancies in the Senate. And he says that that's unconstitutional to not fill the Senate vacancies. But it's easy to see what the plan is from the Conservatives and the Prime Minister during this tumultuous period with the Senate scandal still underway. Just don't touch the Senate. Don't get involved with the Senate and leave it alone. Is that going to work out for the Prime Minister, Paul?
Probably not. You got to understand Stephen Harper's motivation. He named senators. He got in trouble. So he likes to brag that he doesn't make the same mistake twice. So now he's going to not name senators. Turns out that's a different kind of mistake. The Supreme Court has not only been consistent, they've been adamant that first, you can't shut down the Senate without substantial, probably unanimous provincial support. And secondly, you can't ignore the Senate away. You can't leave it empty until tumbleweeds are blowing through the red chamber and then just forget that it was ever there. You have to have not only a Senate, but a functional Senate. And that's why this court challenge to the Prime Minister's refusal to name senators has been allowed to stand against government challenge by the Supreme Court. The court says, no, we're going to hear this case. And so it's possible to imagine, say just a crazy idea, the Conservatives got reelected. It's possible to imagine in the future pretty thoroughly boxed in. There's no route to reform and there's no route to ignoring the thing. You actually have to keep running the Senate. And then they'll be forced to clean it up administratively.
Well, can I interrupt, Paul? Here's a radical idea. What if you carefully named admirable senators?
Yeah.
What if you didn't name hacks and party people who you were naming because you wanted them to work for? What if you carefully sought out people who were going to be beyond reproach? There aren't hundreds of Senate vacancies. There are, a couple of dozen right now. I think about 20 right
20,
now.
Around 20, around 20. Yeah. And possibly more suspensions to come.
Can you not find 20 people who people like us would have trouble arguing with, or people even in your opposition camp would have trouble arguing with you if you named them? I think that is, this sounds like some kind of silly fantasy world, but isn't that the smart strategy right now? Name some senators who people are going to look at and go, well, that person's an Order of Canada recipient who's admired for his philanthropic work, and then you're done.
It's not problem-free, though. One person you could consider naming would be a former Consul General of Canada to New York City, named by the opposition party,
that was
Pamela Wallin.
That is true.
And then
a good point.
That didn't work out too good.
It can always go south, I guess. But I think that is, I think that's generally speaking where any party's going to end up at some point in Canada. We're going to have a more above board strategy, really closer to what Justin Trudeau has sort of hinted that he would put in place, some kind of selection process that is not as open to being slammed as a partisan game.
And the
Senate is just turning into that Ben Stiller movie, Night at the Museum, where after hours, crazy things start to happen.
Pulled it through in the clutch. Sure. All right, thank you.
Attila the Hunt. That's what we want.
Thank you very much, McLean's Ottawa Bureau Chief John Geddes, McLean's political editor Paul Wells, and movie enthusiast. And I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio.
Well, that's it for this week's episode. For more of your politics and power, join us next week on The Hill.